Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I don't think they want more gridlock. I don't think they want more partisanship. I don't think they want more obstruction. They didn't send us to Washington to fight each other in some sort of political steel cage match to see who comes out alive.
President Obama in Baltimore 2 weeks ago speaking to the Republican caucus in an urgent tone, hopeful that bipartisanship is still possible. But not everyone was convinced. Just this week, Senator Evan Bayh announced that he, for one, is giving up.
There is much too much partisanship and not enough progress. Too much narrow ideology and not enough practical problem solving. 2 weeks ago, the Senate voted down a bipartisan commission to deal with one of the greatest threats facing our nation, our exploding deficits and debt. The measure would have passed, but seven members who endorsed the idea, actually co-sponsored the legislation, instead voted no for short-term political reasons.
But today, President Obama is following through on the pledge he made at his State of the Union to make sure that commission happens.
So I'll issue an executive order that will allow us to go forward because I refuse to pass this problem on to another generation of Americans.
Will Obama's executive order only heighten the partisan tension, or will it help start the fix? Or is our two-party system permanently broken? I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. President Obama took office a little over a year ago. He promised change, and that meant change in the way that Washington does business. What does it mean for the state of our nation? And today, with the government, the cycle of mistrust greater than it has been in a long time, we're going to take a look at the most recent failures. And we want you to weigh in with whether you think bipartisanship is even possible. Please call us at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Joining us now is Chris Beam. He's a political reporter for Slate. He's recently published a series of articles on the state of affairs in Washington, and just take a listen to the titles for a sense of where things are going in Washington. State of the Disunion is one. How a Bill Doesn't Become a Law is another. Chris Beam, welcome to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks, Jamie.
And we're hoping folks will weigh in with their sense of partisanship, or maybe some folks think they're still bipartisanship. But, Chris, let's begin with a point that you raise in your both of the articles I've just cited, how closely the country is divided between the two parties. Doesn't that mean that nothing will get done in this country if the two parties can't come together?
Well, yes is the short answer, but, you know, we've had two parties for a long time, and they've managed to agree on the fringes on particular issues while still having their own separate ideologies. I think one of the main frustrations we're seeing right now, and one that Evan Bayh in particular voiced, is a frustration with the filibuster. I mean, this is a very specific Senate procedure that that essentially means you need 60 votes in order to pass any legislation. And we would normally think that you just need a simple majority to pass legislation, 51 votes. But the practice of filibustering legislation means that you need not just a regular majority, but a supermajority, which is a huge frustration to any party that's in the majority, because it means that they can't get anything done. Whether this is different from the past, I think there's more obstructionism happening now, but that's at the same time, it's always happened. It's just right now that Republicans seem more willing to use the filibuster than they have in the past.
I want to come back very specifically to the F word in just a moment and ask you about the filibuster, the history of it, and whether it can, in fact, be done away with it. But let's talk a little bit about whether it's possible to quantify gridlock. Is it possible to run some numbers? Can we compare the current state of affairs to any other points in history in terms of the passage of bills or the use of the filibuster to get a sense of just how gridlocked we are?
Sure. There's no scientific way exactly to measure cooperation or bipartisanship. But if you look at the use of the filibuster, back in the 1960s, about 8% of major bills were getting blocked using the filibuster. This decade, that rate has gone up to 70%. So that's a huge increase. Hmm. You can also look at the use of cloture, which basically means when the majority votes to end debate on a bill. And that's usually in response to a filibuster. That's been going up steadily since the 1960s. Part of this is the shifting of the parties and the realignment of Democrats and Republicans. You know, before there were a lot of issues that Democrats and Republicans could agree on, just because we had a lot of conservative Democrats, a lot of liberal Republicans. There was a lot more overlap, but that realignment has meant that there's a lot less that the two parties can agree on. And so I don't think the increase in filibustering and partisanship is necessarily indicative of senators or members of Congress getting meaner or less friendly. I think it has as much to do with the direction that the parties have taken just in order to get elected.
Well, then let's talk about some of the specifics. In your article, 8 ways to fix the Senate, and then, of course, you say, and why they won't work, you talk about specifics like cloture and filibuster. Paul Krugman and others think the next big battle to be fought over is the rules of the Senate. Maybe we should think about new rules, he suggests. And I wonder, in fact, if any of our listeners have ideas on this. We'd love to hear from them with specific rules changes for the Senate. You can call 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC, or you can go to WNYC.org and click on the Brian Lehrer page if you prefer to post your suggested changes for Senate rules. But let's talk about the filibuster, for example. Chris, tell us a little bit about the history of that rule and why we can't just do away with it. Should it be gotten rid of? And is that even a realistic possibility?
Well, it's been around for more than 200 years. It was created in, I think, 1906. It was a compromise used to allow the minority to have more say in legislation. But it wasn't really used in the 19th century. It's more in the 20th century that it became a common tool for the minority to obstruct legislation. And as we discussed, it was only really since the 1960s that it's become a regular tool. And part of that is because of changes in the parties. Part of it is just because it's there, and people have discovered, they've become more clever about using it.
It became very famous, of course, in the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, right?
Exactly. And it's, to be fair, it's changed a lot since then. You no longer have to stand up there like Jimmy Stewart and talk for 24 hours.
Read from
hours.
The phone book or the dictionary.
Exactly. You can. All you actually really have to do is stand there. You don't even need to talk. But the proposals on the table to change the filibuster mostly involve lowering the number of votes required for cloture from 60. Some say that we should lower it incrementally, so it would start at 60, and then 3 days later it would lower to 57, then 54, and then 51. So that would allow time for debate, but would eventually allow legislation to get passed. Others say we should knock the number down to 55. And the reason I say that these things won't work is that, in the end, I think senators really do like the filibuster. They had the option of abolishing it in 2005. You remember the debate over the nuclear option.
Yes.
The reason the Gang of 14 formed to obstruct that is, I think, it's a tool that when you're in the majority is very frustrating, but when you're in the minority is extremely valuable. And there would be a lot of unintended consequences, I think, from changing the number from 60. Yes, it's a huge frustration for people trying to pass healthcare reform, but imagine all the other pieces of legislation they would oppose that the filibuster allows them to block.
All right, let's take a call from Scott, who is in Weston, Connecticut. Scott, you're on WNYC.
Hi. I'm just listening to what you're saying about procedural changes, and I come back to the fact that I think the lack of bipartisanship is a failure on part of leadership coming from the Obama administration. One of the great hopes that I think all of us had when he was elected was that he would transcend a lot of this bipartisanship. There was all this grassroots support from all these $10 contributors that contributed all these millions of dollars to his campaign. And from what I can see, he hasn't really done much to reach out directly to the people that supported him and impress upon them the necessity of supporting some of these things that I think most Americans recognize need to get dealt with. He's pretty much put his policy in the hands of the Democratic leadership, and they've shown, not to be partisan about it, but they've shown, as the Republicans I think would show under similar circumstances, they've shown an inability to deal with some of these things without overly politicizing it, rather than supporting things which are really sane solutions to some of the problems that we've got.
And yet, Chris Beam, polls suggest that Americans fault Congress more than they fault the Obama administration. What's your reading there at Slate?
Well, I think that you're right that people are frustrated about the administration, you know, what they call not reaching out, and they blame Congress as well for that lack of cooperation. But I think you have to understand that no matter how much a politician talks about bipartisanship, I think they'll only pursue it if it's in their practical interest. Obama talked about about changing the culture of Washington and increasing bipartisanship, but I think it's very difficult to do that in practice if it's in the opposing party's interest to obstruct legislation. And this is something we saw with health care reform. I think even if there were Republicans who were supportive of particular aspects of health care reform, it's still in their interest to oppose the bill overall. And that's why we saw no Republicans voting for it. That's why we saw all Republicans opposing the stimulus package, opposing Obama's budget, because in the end, they may agree with particular aspects of it, but it's still in their electoral interest to oppose it.
All right, let's take a rules change proposal from Rob. Rob, you're on WNYC.
Hi. The issue of lowering the number of votes for cloture to below 60, it's been done before. It was not too many years ago, perhaps 20 years ago, that it required two-thirds of the Senate to invoke cloture, which under the present numbers would mean 66 senators.
And that, you know, Rob has a better recollection than I, but he's triggering something in my memory. Isn't that right, Chris Beam?
That's true. I think it was in the 70s that the Senate decided to lower the number of votes for cloture from two-thirds to three-fifths. That's actually a good point, because one of the reasons I don't think that they're going to lower that any further is that Senate rules say that in order to change Senate rules, you need not 60 votes, but 67 votes. So that two-thirds rule still applies when it comes to changing Senate rules. And I think that's a threshold that, you know, we've seen how difficult it is to get to 60. Imagine how hard it is to get to 67, especially for something as controversial as abolishing or tweaking the filibuster.
Chris, I want to come back to this question of just whom Americans blame. Do they blame the Obama administration? Do they blame Congress? Do they blame senators or their representative? They never want to vote out their own representative. Poll after poll shows that, even though they may blame the body as a whole. And then there's this issue of Republicans as the party of no. David Gregory on Meet the Press asked that very question. There was an exchange last week, and with Representative Aaron Schock, Republican of Illinois. Take a listen.
Congressman Schock, what is the reason that Americans should restore Republicans to power in Congress?
Because there needs to be some balance in Washington. You mentioned 94.
Where's the imbalance now? The president hasn't achieved the big things he's trying to get.
Well, I think his agenda is clearly out of touch with mainstream America. It's why we had a rock star president a year ago with over 80% favorabilities, and now he's below 50%. It's because cap and trade, the stimulus, health care bills are out of touch with where America wants us to be. And the Republican Party has been where we've the American people have been, which is talking about jobs, talking about the economy, talking about tax cuts to get our economy going again. That's what America wants us focused on.
So does it seem, Chris Beam, to you that there is an actual Republican agenda coalescing around this dissatisfaction that the public seems to have with the lack of partisanship in Washington?
I think that the Republicans have started proposing legislative alternatives to, you know, the jobs bill and health care reform. But I think what's a little disingenuous about their case is that the idea that this would somehow balance out the Democrats. As we've seen, the attempts to communicate between the Republicans and Democrats, they haven't yielded a whole lot of substantive compromise, because what the Democrats put on the table for health care reform, for example, is largely incompatible with what the Republicans are proposing. There's no real middle ground there. So even if they could, say, discard partisanship and sit down at the same table, the notion that there's a set of policies that they're going to agree on is a little misleading. And so I think the case that more Republicans need to be elected now to balance out Obama, they're already balancing out Obama. They're preventing mm-hmm. him from getting his agenda passed.
Yeah, the very point that David made in his question to the congressman. You know, maybe the problem is, Chris, the two-party system itself. Here's conservative columnist David Brooks on the same program last weekend.
I'm actually beginning to think, for the first time in my life, there's a prospect for a third party at some point in the future. I just don't see how we get out of the fiscal hole if Republicans are not willing to raise taxes, Democrats not willing to cut spending. I just don't see how we get out of that, and that is the predicate. For the first time in my life, I thought maybe somebody could run a third party for president, not for Congress.
Modern-day Ross Perot.
Hopefully a little saner, but yeah.
So we've not always been Democrats and Republicans in this country, Chris. There have been the Federalists, the Progressives, the Whigs, as David mentions, the Reform Party of Ross Perot. How realistic is it to think of a new party cropping up? It doesn't have to be the Tea Party, necessarily. They would like us to think they're the next best thing. But what about a third party, or maybe, Chris Beam, a transition to a multi-party system?
Sure. I mean, we've already seen a handful of third-party candidates. I mean, Doug Hoffman in the New York 23 election came in and took a lot of the momentum away from the Republican candidate. But I think the reason we're not going to see a larger-scale third-party movement is that the Republicans are catching on, and I think they're perceiving that there is this this dissatisfaction with their current stance, and I think they're trying to absorb the Tea Party movement and the more libertarian anti-government streak of conservatism right now. I think the parties are flexible enough to absorb those people rather than sort of obstruct them and let them go form their own party.
Well, maybe the Dalai Lama can bring some rhyme and reason to Washington, right, Chris?
We shall see. I'd say if he formed a third party,
a lot of people
we might
would
have
follow.
Some change on our hands.
All right, Chris Beam, thank you so much for being with us. Chris is the political reporter at Slate.com. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up next, transportation and the stimulus bill.